Welcome to the Illusion of More podcast.
My guest today is Andrew Orlowski. He's the executive editor of the IT news and opinion website, The Register, and has been writing about internet-related issues for, well, Andrew, you tell me how long you've been writing about.
I think it's over a decade now. I was in San Francisco for about 7 years until a decade ago. So, yeah, that was really the kind of the birth of Google and the internet era we have now.
Tell me what prompted you to start writing about these issues, to become sort of, I guess we'll call it an internet critic, if you will.
It was kind of by accident, I think, like a lot of career choices. I'd been in software development till around 20 years ago when I felt the urge to write. So I'd already started a kind of a muckraking magazine of my own in Manchester in England, and moved to London to write. Found myself writing about technology journalism, technology business for a few years. But after the collapse of the dot-com bubble, I started to be fascinated by the utopian rhetoric that was accompanying changes, and I was fairly skeptical about that kind of utopianism, which seemed to be very shallow, I suppose.
So what prompted me to want to have this conversation was the article you wrote back in the 2nd of February, Alphabetti Spaghetti, Wall Street Isn't Telling You About Google. And so I'll ask real quickly for listeners, if you would recap or summarize the main point of that article, if you would.
There's a few things going on. One is, as we all know, what passes for an economy, a digital economy, is very reliant, disproportionately reliant on advertising.
Correct.
In the advertising space, there's one dominant player, and then there's a marketplace of players who've copied its business model. So the trouble really starts, and this is where I kind of got interested in the cultural aspects of it. Around about early 2003, Google began to make a lot of money from scaling up the automated placement of adverts. Now, I think in the article I point out this is not a bad thing. There are things machines can do well. Computers and the internet do things at scale very well. So this is a business that has low value, low margin, but enormous scale of millions and billions of ads. What was unusual about the creation of this business was that Google did not allow arbitrage. So it's not a true marketplace. Google operates an auction. Google was very clever. If we wind back a step to around 2000, the idea that machines would do the buying and selling of advertisements was viewed to be useful to about 50 companies on the planet. Google's genius was realizing that it was actually a scale business, and it did it very well. So people who had never thought that they would get digital advertising on their sites, like bloggers, started to get pennies and then pounds. And that's all well and good. Yeah, so the problem is, really, it's not a true marketplace. Now, if you want to buy advertising space and want to see which advertising service gets you the best deal, you can't do that. And Google worked very hard to make sure that it doesn't operate in a competitive marketplace, but it is the marketplace.
It seemed to me the point, and you're not the only one to write about this, of course, of that article, is that now what we're seeing in this very complex automated market is a fairly high rate of waste for advertisers. And loss, if that's a correct way to characterize it. You mentioned in the article that some 52% of online ads are never seen by humans.
Yeah, I can explain ad fraud for a little for a moment. Fraud is where machines, robots, click the advertisement and it's never seen. So a buyer buys some advertising space, and they'll buy a certain number of clicks. Once a certain threshold of clicks has been reached, the advertisement disappears. They may never be seen by humans because a fraudulent operator in the middle will click on the advertisement and it disappears. So it's been money wasted as far as the advertiser, the brand, or whoever it is paying for the advertisement is concerned. The middleman has taken his cut, and this is a significant cost of business. There's been one outstanding article investigative article on this, which appeared in Business Week last year. Mm-hmm. The link in where they interviewed some of the fraudulent players, and I think it did a great job of explaining the complexity of in the middle of this system. We're overly reliant on advertising in place of a transactional economy. In fact, real money changing hands for goods, particularly digital goods, and that affects creators. And the kind of the winners today of this what I regard as very exploitative model, which doesn't return the value to the people who should have more value returned to them, particularly creators, is that the winners of today are rather conservative and fight very aggressively to stop a transaction-based alternative, which I think would unlock a lot of value and which I think they would actually prosper in from taking place.
In terms of relevance for, let's say, users of the internet, people think of advertising as just sort of this nuisance thing that is in the way of whatever it is they're trying to do on the internet, without really digesting the fact that the internet as we know it has been built as a machine for either delivering ads or gathering market data for the purpose of advertising.
Yeah.
And then if that system, if that ecosystem is weakened, if advertisers, for example, lose confidence in that system to the extent that, you know, any kind of tipping point where they start to really bail, that's more or less the internet that we know today, gone, right?
I don't think it's gone. The way I describe it is, you can pin almost all of the problems of the internet to not enough money changing hands.
Mm-hmm.
And it's difficult for a newspaper to attract people to a subscription when there is advertising, and in something you write a lot about, we write a lot about piracy as well.
Mm-hmm.
These things are kind of have quite subtle relationships.
Right.
Now, I think the value would be unlocked. I mean, it's difficult and awkward for consumers to take out their credit card every time somebody wants money. And yet, if you look around you, there are parallels where you get, say, healthcare in Europe, where you don't get sent a bill, but lots of money has changed hands.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every good in the household, there'll be a massive chain of transactions behind it. We really want kind of internet commerce to be as easy as that. And there are other examples as well. I don't know if you have this direct analog in the US, but we have shops here called newsagents who will send you a bill at the end of every week. They know who you are and they trust you, and they'll lose some money to fraud, but not a lot. Mm-hmm. That's kind of unimaginable on the internet. It's very, it's just a standard thing in real life. Is they advance you some credit and then they send you the bill. Where the advertising business comes in is that it's strange that some industries have become so reliant on it. Like, mm-hmm. I think music is overly reliant on advertising. If we have another one, if we posit an alternative world where transactions happen at scale, I don't see any reason why the winners of this era of the internet shouldn't prosper as well, because all they do is run machines that count very quickly, so that it should suit them very well. I mean, it's hard to imagine the future. I find it the hardest job in writing is when you meet politicians or policymakers to describe to them a world that is different to the internet as it is today, even though they can see the analogs with the real world. But I think once the incentives are aligned up, things happen very, very quickly. Marketplaces evolve and people cooperate very well. There's a common goal and there's some money there.
Well, some of the things that come to my mind and that I'm starting to write about this month is sort of larger picture economics. For example, you mentioned even at the beginning of this Alphabet-y spaghetti. And by the way, for listeners who don't know, Alphabet is the new parent company of Google, for anybody who might have missed that memo, which it could be easy to miss, to be honest.
That's a great headline. I didn't write that headline, but she'd get a lot of credit for that. It's a beautiful headline.
It is very good. But anyway, in that article, you begin by mentioning that Google has only recently, and probably this will go back and forth, but they recently surpassed Apple in terms of their valuation.
Yeah.
As the biggest, the biggest company, at least on paper, in the world. Of course, the contrast between those companies, right, is part of a larger economic debate, certainly one that we're having in this country, which is, Google's valuation at what is it now? We're coming close to $700 billion or something like that. is against about approximately $6 billion in free flowing cash. Whereas Apple's almost equivalent valuation is against free flowing cash of $46 billion. Mm. And of course, Google's not unique in this, in the sense that, you know, so many Silicon Valley plays, I think of Uber as a huge example, are really about winner take all kind of plays, right? Which is part of what you're talking about, in the sense that Google is not really, it's not open to a competitive market. It wants to be the market.
Yeah, that's right.
But then the question I ask is, okay, so you have, you know, you have these companies that are sort of winner take all plays. They're not they're not truly returning a traditional, you know, dividends on their massive investments. And then the advertising ecosystem itself is at least being threatened by fraud and some of the other.
Yeah.
So at what point do we say, you know, is this potentially a very huge bubble that we're looking at for a lot of these businesses?
I wouldn't use the phrase bubble. I mean, okay. One interesting comparison is that a company's valuation today has a lot of what people expect it to do in the future and how popular they expect it to be in the future. I don't see advertising going away. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'm biased because I've worked in commercial journalism for 20 years, but advertising is traditionally supported an incredible diversity of voices and publications. And, you know, the Register is kind of one of them.
I mean, right.
It was not the way you're supposed to do tech journalism or enterprise IT coverage, but it succeeded not because it was blessed by experts, but because the publishing gurus, it succeeded largely through, it was exactly what kind of the industry, people who worked there wanted to read. Advertising allowed that. I think advertising will be there in 10 or 20 years time. Mm-hmm. But this model creates so many losers. People need to think let's kind of build something alongside it and see how that works. Because currently, I mean, Google is extracting rent from its advertising monopoly. And that, I would say it's not going to burst, but it may wish to think that transactions are more attractive and safer, and it might actually be quite good at them. It started to ask for money for Google, YouTube, but I just don't see a lot of innovation going on. Spotify is basically the same as it was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. How many new ideas in presenting and consuming music have we seen in the last few years since streaming happened? Very few.
Right.
So this isn't a world of innovation, and it's a world where giant, I call them plantation owners, but it's that network effect you described a moment ago, you know, the winner takes all. Mm-hmm. You know, they're extracting rent from a large number of people and returning only a fraction of its value back down the chain. Mm-hmm. And I think simply as a case of de-risking its own business, Google might start increasingly to look at how to make transactions nice. I mean, kind of just easy for us to do, you know, just like click and here's a bundle of stuff. Click here and here's some other bundle, and there's competitive people entirely, you know, creating markets as it goes along. To me, the great fear is that politicians step in and just say, can we just make the problem go away by collectivizing rights? To me, that's more of a threat to creators. And I mean, creators are besieged with problems, but that seems to be one that should be borne in mind. We should all think about how to make the markets work rather than making the problem go away. Mm-hmm. Politicians, because they're just making us go away.
Well, do you mind expanding on that? What you mean in terms of politicians recommending collectivizing?
Well, it was actually Rob Levine, who's a writer I'd like very much. He wrote the book Free Ride. Mm-hmm. Got me thinking on this because he's very keen that copyright has these kind of two ideas. One's a very practical Anglo-American view, where it's very utilitarian.
Yep.
It's not, you know, it's not something out of rights. And then there's the European view, which is it's all about the rights and expression of the human, and mm-hmm. and that has to be satisfied. It's actually a mixture of both. If we simply regard it as a utilitarian approach, then the temptation is for policymakers to give somebody almost like a welfare check, mm-hmm. and to go away. And I don't think creators want welfare.
Right.
I think they want to be able to trade fairly in a marketplace. Right. Trade their rights fairly.
Are you saying American politicians can be a little bit literal?
Yes, I think all politicians can. I mean, it's very difficult with them. They you know, in my experience, they do mean well, but they don't have. It's very difficult to imagine a future that isn't here yet, and so they tend to trust the people who've been successful in the plantation era of the internet to tell them what's going to happen in the next era.
Yeah.
And surprise, surprise, the next era for a Google looks exactly like this one.
Funny how that.
Because why would it look like anything else?
That's right. Quite natural. Right. And I agree with you about, you know, the distinction between the utilitarian and rights-based notion of copyright. I've tried to stress the rights-based history of that in a couple of articles, but in terms of the future, I'll ask perhaps a devil's advocate question that goes back to advertising, in fact, which is, of course, many people are talking about whether or not automation will bring about a jobless future, or a semi-jobless future.
Yeah,
and certainly, even if the more dire predictions of that are unfounded. Certainly it's true in our economy anyway, that consolidation is actually reducing consumer choice. While it feels as though we have so much, right? There's abundance. The reality is that, you know, think of another search engine that's truly competitive with Google.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that there isn't really another big box store that's competitive with Walmart or another, or another Amazon, right? So, it occurs to me that if in fact we start to see a decline in work, several writers have talked about uncertain work and piecemeal work that even college graduates are finding themselves doing in this economy. And at the same time, you begin to reduce consumer choice. The question I ask is, well, then at what point does marketing have any value at all? You know, you think of something like the pharmaceutical industry. If all of a sudden you really have very little choice as to where to get your medical care, or your drugs, there's really almost no value in them researching you.
I think that's a really interesting point. I've not really thought about it before. I think marketing has value, but what you see before then is companies de-risking what they do, which leads to a much kind of flatter world. So we have, I don't want to employ a cliche, but we have large record companies which now are almost scientific in how they pick the successful artists.
Right.
We have guys in a shed who, you know, independents, of course, that's, you know, it's a travesty. I'm massively oversimplifying. Will take risks. But we don't have the kind of mid-sized record companies who could kind of offer artists a major-like investment over several years, but still be quite nimble and take risks. That's like oversimplified. I mean, people in the industry would think that's a horrific description, because it does oversimplify dozens of things. And might even be a caricature. But I think before we see people questioning whether they should spend money, we just see decisions on production just being much more conservative and risk averse.
Well, and I think we're seeing that. I mean, you know, we are. It may be an oversimplification, but I think as our candidate Senator Sanders will say, the middle class is disappearing. This is true of the middle class creator as well. And it's true throughout the market, not just in the creative sectors, but in others as well, which is what I'm getting back to about consumer choice. In fact, I was thinking about this in a piece that I wrote a while back, in the sense that people, you know, one of the sort of utopian views of a future with less work is, oh, well, then, you know, people will sort of settle into a Keynesian, you know, sort of leisure class, and they'll create, you know, they'll be more creative with their time. And, you know, perhaps there won't be TV stations, but they'll all make videos on YouTube. And my question is, well, why is there a YouTube? If YouTube is driven by advertising and consumers have fewer choices, it's not profitable in this market. Why would it be profitable in a future market?
Yeah, I think you would lead to great. I mean, there's no reason why. There are some interesting ideas for a universal wage, for example, and I think these are kind of, it's really interesting to kind of discuss these things, because this is, I mean, there are people talking about this kind of post-work future. But even in a post-work future, people should be rewarded fairly for the work they do. I don't think anybody, or very few people, would think they're creating great music or great videos at home and yet it's for some collective good. And if the collective good turns out to be a giant multinational.
Sure.
That's
well, I mean, in you know, to be honest, I don't actually have any belief in that future at all.
Yeah, I think computers are getting more stupid. I don't think they're getting cleverer.
To come back to advertising specifically today, do you think that there's an extent to which as we see more and more things like click fraud and piracy affecting the value of advertising and some of the other types of fraud that are occurring that are sort of draining the value, is there an extent to which this is sort of Silicon Valley's anything goes ethos coming around to bite it in the butt?
I think you're onto something there in that there's a lot of pigeons coming home to roost. For sort of 15 or 20 years, it's been very easy for, say, software to disrupt, you know, traditional industries. And this is the great phrase that we're disrupting and we're improving them and, you know, we're making things always better for the consumer and always cheaper. That's actually a natural process. That's 200 years old. Mm-hmm. Not software specifically, but companies have to make improvements in efficiency and how they sell and respond to technological advance.
Right.
Silicon Valley has kind of had the zero-sum game. I mean, Marc Andreessen, who I think was horribly misquoted last week, actually, but he's on record of the venture capitalist saying, you know, Hollywood has to lose for us to win. So it's got this kind of zero-sum attitude, which I just find incomprehensible and quite socially divisive for no reason at all. I mean, for a start, you don't have to win. The best technology might have to win. Maybe that involves partnering with industries, and it has to offer value, and it has to be a non-coercive relationship. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the ideology that Silicon Valley has created for itself is kind of, I mean, that's a great point. It's kind of imprisoned in this rhetoric now.
But I also mean even in actual dollars, you know, if, again, you're saying that it's unlikely the advertising community will necessarily, you know, lose faith in online advertising, you know, absolutely, and just kind of abandon ship. And I'm sure that's the case. But at the same time, that community has begun to look at loss. They've funded reports and have made, you know, at least overt efforts to keep their advertising off pirate sites. They are taking a serious look at what the cost is. You know, on their bottom line, and at a certain point, that gives them certainly leverage when talking to Google. That's to say, right. You know, you need to clean this up.
Well, Google needs to clean things up. I mean, there's kind of the two interlinked conversations in parallel. One is Google's business practices with regards to creators, and quite clearly in 2006, YouTube. And when Google was acquiring YouTube, it was offering piracy protection only if people opted into Google's advertising program, which paid much less than rival advertising programs. How on earth that is legal, I really don't know. But that strikes me as a classic competition case where politicians can do something there to try and encourage a market. Mm-hmm. The wider case is how the advertising industry cures itself of something, a monster it created itself. The design creates enormous incentives for fraudulent and unethical players. So they're not totally separate conversations, and but they are, I think they're on separate tracks. I mean, the reason there's a backlash against by huge brand advertisers who spend billions and the reason that there's a backlash against the agencies is it hasn't a lot to do with Google, but they don't see how they can get their money well spent in the system, which is entirely fraudulent. Now, I think there are some technical solutions, but there has to be an enormous will on the part of Madison Avenue to clean up its act. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it acknowledging the scale of the problem yet.
We've talked rather speculatively. What is your, if you're willing to, what is your gut feel about where we're headed 4 or 5 years from now?
I don't know, but to me, the biggest swindle that Silicon Valley has ever perpetrated successfully is persuading people to act against their own economic interests and to campaign against rights that are very strong, very hard for in the first place. And I suspect that the pressure will come from people who may not be professionals, but they see why do I have to give everything away, particularly images or creative work, and then the audiovisual sector. It's really strange for people to cheer when their own rights get hacked to pieces. I find that really, really strange. I can't see that sustaining, but, you know, it's very effective propaganda so far to say the internet's breaking. It could get to the point where, almost like in Britain, we have the EU is breaking. People now say, so what? Maybe we'll get to a stage where like, the cry goes up yet again if the internet's breaking. People will go, well, good, it's rubbish.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
I want a better one.
Well, and on that subject, something I've been thinking about in the last couple of weeks is of course the rise of Bernie Sanders among my fellow progressives, and I count myself a progressive and generally a liberal. But you know, they are eager to send Bernie to Washington to quote you know, put the hammer to Wall Street. Whether or not he will is a completely separate conversation. But this is certainly what they believe. And at the same time, I suspect, particularly in the 18 to 29-year-old category that really, really, really is eager to see this candidate in the White House, is unaware, for example, of the extent to which they, every time they order up an Uber car or even really share their thoughts about Bernie on Facebook, are literally telling Wall Street to go for it.
Interesting.
And this is the dichotomy that I'm not sure will be reconciled. For example, if they got their wish, if Bernie ended up in the White House and he began to say, okay, we're going to go, you know, we're going to go after them. And it turns out that may include some regulations on companies like Google, state regulations on companies like Uber. That all of a sudden, you and I both know what those companies are going to say. They're going to say the government is gunning for the internet.
Yeah.
Again, and I wonder if Mr. Sanders supporters would get it.
It's a really interesting point that people. There's a few things going on there, David. I think there's a disconnect between young people, and the kind of the political power behind the service they use. I think part of the problem is, I've referred to elites and kind of our intelligentsia has let us down horribly here. My favourite American writer on politics is a guy called Gerald Kotkin, and he's a working-class Brooklyn guy. Mm-hmm. And he kind of makes the point, look, we know all about Wall Street's 1%, and the 1% should be in prison. It's astonishing nobody was put in prison for the racket. That caused so much long-lasting economic damage. But he says, what about the 15%? They act entirely in their own interests. And by here, he's referring to kind of media elites and academic elites. Mm-hmm. And he says they support causes which are directly socially divisive. My response to kind of the Sanders thing is, well, he's kind of doing really, is his background an elite background with some populism on top? Or does he really want to think of a less socially divisive world, as I think we all do? Mm. He'd probably want to say he does too. How many of those policies are really going to, you know, help people who aren't already on the ladder? I think the intellectual left has a problem with the M word of markets, because after Reagan and Thatcher, they saw their own virtue as protecting people from markets. Mm. Now, in intellectual property and digital, the one thing we haven't got is markets. This is why I find Morozov particularly, you know, very intelligent writer on and critic of Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. He's convinced it's a neoliberal conspiracy. And I kind of always point out, well, where's the market? There's no market. Right. Spend some time arguing for a marketplace where an individual can trade fairly. Very hard if you spent 30 years in an ivory tower pontificating about how markets are evil to kind of do that switch. I don't think it's difficult for ordinary people, because most of us live in this kind of the middle ground, where you want markets, but you want them, you know, sensible regulated markets. I think it's quite hard. I don't think we've been terribly well led or advised there. And that's something that goes across the political and the academic
elites. Well, listen, I've taken up a ton of your time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Absolute pleasure, David. I really enjoy your writing so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening. I'm David Newhoff. This is the Illusion of More podcast.